something a bit different for you today on Conversations. As part of Australian Music Month, every year our colleagues at Double J present a special live interview and performance series. It's called Songs of Your Streets. This is a series that highlights how Australian towns and cities have shaped Australian music and Australian songwriters. This year, Powderfinger frontman, solo artist Bernard Fanning talked to Double J's Jacinta Parsons about his home city of Brisbane. For all his enormous success as a singer-songwriter and performer, Bernard Fanning has always been one of the most down-to-earth of rock stars, and his songs have often been rooted in home and family. And this event was recorded with an audience at the ABC's studios in Brisbane.
G'day. Hello.
Hi, everyone.
Now, you were the last kid to arrive on the scene in your family house in Toowong. Four kids, John, Carmel, Paul, and you.
Yep.
Your mum, Margaret, and your sister, Carmel, are in the audience tonight, so we'll need to be careful. But by the sounds of that life, growing up in Brisbane during the 70s and 80s sounded pretty idyllic.
Yeah, it was, actually. It was incredible. Just thinking about what we were doing today and thinking about growing up in Toowong and wondering if you could actually have a more privileged kind of upbringing, really, in terms of not that we were really rich or anything like that. I just mean that it was a really comfortable environment, but it was also really safe and really fun. So we were allowed to be kind of free range. We could get out and do, from about the time we were about 10, we could go and do whatever we wanted on our bikes, you know,
BMX.
All around the neighbourhood. Brisbane was a different kind of place then.
Really different to today, would you say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was much more laid back. You just live in your own little circle. And Toowong was, we lived in a circle. I mean, we were Catholics, so we went to the convent.
To become, you know, a nun?
No. More on that later.
This is the thing we're going to reveal.
I'm actually a nun, sister.
Talking about the convent, I want to kick straight into talking about a nun by the name of Sister Mary Leonard.
Yes.
How much can she claim for the musician that sits before us?
None.
10%?
No.
Give her something.
More out of revenge than anything, I guess. No, she taught me piano for about 4 or 5 years, but Mum taught me first. Mum taught me for a year or so when I was about 5. And then I went and had lessons from Sister Mary Leonard, who was, I think she probably meant well, but she was she wasn't a kind soul, I wouldn't say. I mean, she was very much in that old school kind of Catholic way of teaching, which was to, you know, hit you if you made a mistake.
How good is this audience that you just were told that you were hit and we had a great laugh?
Well, I mean, look, absolutely no disrespect to any of the people who have become victims of the abuse within the Catholic Church, because it was hideous. But it wasn't anything like that. It was more psychological abuse. I did a theory exam once and I got 100%. And when we were being handed back the exams, she was going, you know, Kelly, 95, Doolin, you know, 99, Fanning, Fluke, 100.
You wanted to leave piano, but you made a deal with your mum.
Yeah. I said to Mum, okay, I'm not doing piano anymore. And she said, no, you've got to keep going. And I said, okay, I'll keep doing it if I can just do no exams and just learn Beatles songs. So that's what I did. I'd changed teachers by then. I'd changed to a really great teacher, this lady called Marcia Corcoran. Very encouraging and a really decent, awesome human. And a great teacher. So, yeah, I was able to just learn Beatles songs.
Do you reckon that had a huge influence then, ultimately, around the craft of songwriting?
I think it does, you know. Like, I was lucky because growing up I had a brother that was 10 years older, so he already had all this. We had access to all this music that wasn't really of our generation or our sub-generation, I guess. So we were listening to the Beatles from when we were little, really little.
And your songwriting started about when you were 15. Was it an immediate thing for you? Did you start writing great songs straight off?
No, I didn't.
Do you remember that?
I don't know if anybody does.
Do you remember that very first one you ever wrote?
I do remember it.
And I'm going to make you play it, aren't I? So this is the very first song. How old are you?
It would have been pretty much straight away, as soon as I learned chords. And so it was like, I want you. Yeah, something like this. I want you. Oh, yeah, I'll just preface this, actually, by saying I wrote this and then I played it to my sister. So, right? I want you. It's deep as. Yeah, I need you. Well, I love you so. Baby, please don't go. So it's something like that, right?
That's not bad.
Yeah, but and she goes, that's a Meatloaf song.
Good work, Carmel. You also used to go down to Harlequin Records.
Yeah.
And
Indro.
Indropilly. Yeah. And buy albums. What were the albums that you were buying when you could?
Well, Paul, my immediately older brother, who I, you know, basically grew up with, he and I had a lawn mowing business, which we kind of inherited from our older brother. And somehow Paul used to make a lot more money out of it than I did. And there was always a claim that I did less work, but that was absolute bullshit, wasn't it, Mum? Anyway, so Paul was kind of funding the record buys most of the time. I remember he bought Let's Dance and then all the Kiss stuff, buying cassettes, you know, and then eventually into, you know, Led Zeppelin and Sabbath, big dumb 70s rock.
There was some soul interest as well, though, wasn't there?
Yeah, well, I was kind of aware of soul music and James Brown and whatever, I guess. But one of the guys from Toowong, we used to get together every Friday night, a whole gang of us, and he gave me a cassette of this record of Sam Cooke's, which was called Live at the Harlem Square Club, which is a really famous, one of the most famous live albums of all. And that just hit me really hard. Didn't realise how much that 70s rock actually relied on soul as well. I'd never realised.
So, you've got a Sam Cooke song in your pocket for us tonight.
Yes.
Which one is it?
There's a song called Lost and Looking, which to the casual observer sounds like three verses that are verses and choruses that are pretty much the same. It's a blues. But that's the key to Sam Cooke, is these subtle melodic differences that he makes.
Okay. Gordon Fanning, Sam Cooke, cover here and on the piano. Make him welcome as he walks across.
I'm lost and looking for my baby. Wonder why my baby can't be found. Oh, I'm lost and looking for my baby. My baby ain't around. Oh, I'm lost and searching for my baby. Wonder why my baby can't be found. Oh, searching for my baby. Lord knows my baby ain't around.
Now we're about to go deep into your life of music and how Brisbane played a central role to that story. Mm-hmm. But we can't go much further without talking about the other great love of your life, your mum Margaret, and also...
Yes, mother.
Of course, that other love, cricket. There's a great shot of you when you're about 3 years old with a... Is it a cover drive that you were doing?
No, that's a sweep, Jacinda.
Awkward.
And it was 4 bits. Yeah, that was my first brush with fame, actually. It was in the newspaper. I don't know, I was about 5, I think, in the late 70s. The Sunday Mail used to just have random shots from around Brisbane. They used to have the results of our games of cricket as well. So, like, the West's 6 Bs, like Bernard Fanning, 8 not out, stuff like that. I mean, 108 not out, sorry.
You and your brother Paul would spend hours, as you mentioned before, in the backyard playing cricket. There's something so evocative about that. Even for me, I used to play with my brothers and they would stick me with the Dennis Lilly badge that they had to threaten me with things. Is it easy for you as well to conjure up those memories?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was the most telling part of my childhood was in the backyard playing sport with my brother and other dudes from around the Toowong as well.
Your brother, older brother John was pretty good too.
Oh yeah,
though,
John was
he?
Really good cricketer, yeah.
Yeah.
So he was playing, like, that was part of the reason that we were so into cricket was because when he was 18, so I was 8, he was playing first grade cricket for West and, you know, went on a Queensland Colts tour around the world playing cricket. You know, that was very important to us.
You recently stated that your number one cricket moment of all time was when Queensland won the Sheffield Shield for the first time in 1995. Yep. Of all the cricket moments. We are so in front of a Queensland audience, aren't we?
Oh, well, but I think everyone here gets
how,
it.
you must feel Queensland pretty deep.
Oh, yeah, but that was a whole different level, the Shield. Because every other state took so much pleasure in denying us. It was part of the kind of makeup of Australian cricket was to make sure that Queensland never won the Shield. So when we did, it was glorious.
Were you there?
I was there, on the hill. Shit-faced.
Have your two loves, cricket and music, converged often?
Not that many times.
But secret they songs have, about cricket?
Yeah, there is one song about cricket. And you've got to understand also that at the time, that this is a Powderfinger song called SS. When we were writing Powderfinger, we were playing cricket all the time as well. So in the yard, that's what we did when we were having breaks. We would play cricket.
Who was the best cricketer in the band?
I was. Come on, I was the lead singer. I'm the best at everything.
Now, SS... It's about a cricket bat, SS, isn't it?
Stuart Surridge, yeah, is the brand, yeah.
Bernard Fanning and SS.
Sweetest jolting of the memory, little secrets become fantasies. Stuart Surridge never growing tired. Little boys bathed and safe inside. These things are mine for always. We can hold our breath till we all turn blue, and then we'll race like jets for the fading moon, and we'll all fall down.
That voice, the first time anyone copped to listen to that was at the Royal Exchange. Is that true?
Yes.
The RE.
Right. Yeah, I lost a bet, actually. We used to go and drink there. So Paulie and I and our other mate, Easy, who I kind of also grew up with, we used to go there on Tuesdays, Thursdays and Sundays. So we got to know lots of people down there. And there was one particular group of people. I think they were like a basketball team or something like that from some local comp. They used to lose. They lost like a whole season. Every single game got absolutely pissed on, you know. And anyway, it had all worked out that these guys somehow knew that I was playing guitar and singing songs in my bedroom, basically, and they said, okay, if we win a game, you have to get up and play a song. And I was like, oh, yeah, no worries. And they f***ing won a game.
Was it Tuesday, Thursday or Sunday that you had to do it?
It was a Sunday. So it was, that was bad. Because that was Sunday session in those days. That was when the pub on Sunday was only open from 4 to 8. So you had to really get cracking at 4 o'clock.
It wasn't long after that that you collided with a guitarist named Hoggy.
Yep.
Who had just formed a little three-piece band by the name of Powderfinger.
Yeah.
You met him in economics, classic, at Queensland University.
I knew him anyway. I knew who he was, and I'd seen him at gigs and stuff like that, but we actually ended up sitting down and talking at UQ, We were doing an economics class together.
You were destined to...
just so you know, and Hoggy passed.
Do you, like, from that meeting ensued this huge story, you know, 22 years with that band... Do you believe in destiny?
I don't know. I don't really think about it like that. Being in, I guess, the position that Powderfinger got to, where we were pretty popular in Australia and quite well known, people say, what's, you know, what happened? How do you become successful? And no one knows. It's just a fluke. I mean, Sister Leonard was right, I guess. But there's all these flukes that happen, but you have to be, like, ready to go to the next step, I guess. Like, you have to really do a lot of work to be prepared when opportunities come to kind of step up to the next level from being playing at the RE and then playing at the Orient and then playing at the Roxy or the Zoo and then the Roxy and being good enough to kind of step up each time, or if you get offered a support with a bigger band, being good so that the band, all the fans of that band see you and they want to come and see you play next time at your own show.
And there's something unique as well about the chemistry of... bands.
Oh, yeah. That's the key. Yeah.
You know, it's not about the best drummer. It's the best... Well, you're obviously the best guitarist, but, you know, like...
Oh, yeah, clearly.
...singer. But it's about that kind of thing at that point in time.
It is totally about that. That's what makes great bands, is that only those guys or girls or that combination of people can make that sound. That's what makes bands have a lasting effect. I think the combination of the way Hoggy plays guitar, JC plays bass, Cogsy plays drums, Darren plays guitar and I sing, that's the kind of indefinable thing. And the way that the ideas combine as well, you know, that becomes... Because it's really, being a band that writes songs is all about communication and how you communicate with each other. And we were terrible at it in Powderfinger at times. We were really, really bad, like a bunch of sooky... pains in the ass, really, myself included, very rarely, but sometimes. But yeah, it's one of those things where you have to work out how to deal with each other as well.
One of the great features, or possibly even the most complex features of Powderfinger, is the democracy of that band. The six members, including Paul Petico, was always this idea that each of you were equal. Do you think you credit your 22-year marriage with that?
Oh, I think that's a very big part of it. And I think that goes for lots of bands that have that longevity. Midnight Oil were the same. That thing where there's no point in anybody being more important than anybody else, because in the end you all get in the van and go on the road together.
Do you think Brisbane had a part to play in it as well, being a band in this city at that time?
I joined the band in 1989, and that's kind of right when there was the end of the wash-up of all the Fitzgerald inquiry and all of the National Party and police corruption that had been exposed, you know, throughout the late 80s. And Brisbane in particular started to change, where it wasn't such a police state anymore. I mean, that's why bands had left. That's why the Go-Betweens and the Saints and all those guys left, because whenever they put on a gig, the cops would come and beat the shit out of everyone. You know, especially the punk scene, that's what happened here. And then by the time we were doing gigs, that just didn't exist. So we did have a different freedom to all those guys that came before us. Okay, this next song is called Sink Low. It was on Powderfinger's first record, which was imaginatively titled Parables for Wooden Ears, which actually comes from a Rodriguez lyric where he talks about some boy with wooden eyes or something. And we were like, wow, that's so poetic. Anyway, this is Sink Low.
Sure is quiet around here. The phone never rings anymore. So I'll wallow in silence, nail my soul to the floor. 'Cause I'm angry and jealous and sick and tired of untrue. And I'm lonely, my pride is bruised, my wheels turn slow, love's candle burns low. Whoa.
We're at the part of the story where you got to wave goodbye to your mum, Margaret, and your dad, John, and over the coming 22 years, Powderfinger pretty much hit the road fairly relentlessly, playing all over this country and around the world. And I loved finding out that you were still mowing lawns right up until and even beyond the release of Double Allergic.
Yeah, all around the place. All of us were. We were all doing jobs. We used to do these traffic surveys. So you'd sit on the side of the road and count cars. It was mind-numbing, but it was big bucks.
If you look at it on paper, it seems like it was a pretty quick thing, this Powderfinger kind of rise to fame. But there were countless kilometres that you drove and shows that you did up and down the East Coast for, you know, years, like building that audience and that live show.
Yeah, so from about 92 to 95... we probably were going every 6 weeks, driving from Brisbane to Adelaide to Melbourne to Sydney and then back, and playing a weekend's worth. We did lots of miles.
And for some guys in the band, maybe even including you, playing gigs around Australia was some of the first time you'd ever left Brisbane.
Yeah, I'd been to Sydney once before when we went on like a family truckster vacation, and then the next time I went was like 1992. I remember walking down Pitt Street and going, wow, this is really unfriendly, this place. Like kind of looking at people, hey. And them just going, who's this loser?
In some of the early interviews, there was this beautiful one I saw, and it was after the release of Double Allergic and things is really building, and someone said to you, what's it like, all this, that you're making it? And you said, you've got to understand, we're from Brisbane. You know, we're down to earth. What do you think it is about Brisbane that...
Oh, I don't know. There's probably a bit of myth-making in that anyway, don't you think?
I don't know. Is it a tall poppy thing?
Oh, probably. Paranoia about it on our behalf. Yeah, of not getting too far ahead. I mean, it's really an Australian thing more than a Brisbane thing, I reckon, that idea, which is there's healthy aspects of it and there's really unhealthy aspects of it as well that kind of... deriding people for success and everything. We were really lucky. We were mostly treated with a lot of respect along the way. But I think it's also because people realised that we weren't really taking the piss and that we also worked really hard. I think people appreciate that.
Did success sit with you very well?
No, I was really uncomfortable with it, actually. With being recognised and stuff like that, I really struggled with that. It wasn't that I didn't want to talk to people. It wasn't that. It was just that I didn't want it to affect what was actually happening in my life or the people around me, like my girlfriend at the time or any of that stuff. So I think that's what I was more concerned about. It probably sounds a little bit precious to say that I didn't really cope with it very well, and I didn't really, but I probably internalised that and I didn't. People weren't really that aware of it. I was worrying about that privately more than anything.
When a band like Powderfinger is cooked up in a rehearsal room with five mates who are playing cricket, how do you maintain the innocence of that creative pursuit when it becomes almost like a business, when that success grows and people are needing things from you?
our test was basically if you had a song where at least a few of you got the hair to stand up on the back of your neck, if you're working on something, that was always the test, really. And, I mean, we wrote songs that were unashamedly kind of emotional songs and everything. We weren't concerned with being those dudes who were the obscure, weird ones or anything. We were always trying to be creative in our own way, but we weren't really concerned about that idea of having to be super arty or anything like that. We were all pretty happy with pop songs. I mean, they were rock songs, but it's essentially pop structures and stuff like that, I guess. You just knew. You had that feeling. So we didn't really have to discuss it very much, you know. It wasn't one of those things where we sat down and deconstructed the way we were feeling about stuff. We were always trying to move forward and do the next thing. We didn't think about the successes we'd had or anything like that.
We made you pick one of the big songs to play tonight. Which one did you end up choosing for us?
I ended up choosing These Days.
It's yes!
Probably... it's probably, I mean, along with My Happiness and On My Mind, they're probably the three most well-known Powderfinger songs. We used to call them the Holy Trinity for a joke. It's like, we've got to play the Holy Trinity at the end of the show.
How do you keep that stuff still fresh when you're playing material that belongs to everybody else now?
I think that's what you end up having to... You have to understand that the whole reason that you're there playing in front of 10,000 people or whatever is because of those songs.
Creeping hand of time and its commands. Soon enough it comes and settles in its place. Its shadow in my face puts pressure in my day. This life, well, it's slipping right through my hands. Days turned out nothing like I had planned.
You said to me on the phone when we were chatting about tonight, kind of half joking, that everything good happens in Toowong. It's a place that holds this beautiful, rich layer of your family history, but it's also a place that holds the most significant moments of loss for you. One of those was when your eldest brother, John, who introduced you to music, and he led the way through your life, died in 2002 when he was just 42 years of age.
Yeah.
You were only 32 at the time. Mm-hmm. How did you handle that loss?
Well, it was the first time anything like that had happened to me or to anyone in our family, really. So that was a complete shock. Looking back on it now, I think we probably ended up handling it as best we could because everybody just banded together and tried to help him while he was sick, especially, and his immediate family around him. But, you know, it had a big rolling impact on everybody for a long time. You know, having never really experienced anything like that, it was really natural for me to turn to music to make it feel better for me. You know, people always say about dealing with pain is, you know, that you confront it. And that's what writing the songs really did. And, I mean, I guess I would say that I probably had an understanding of blues, really, for the first time in my life. And I mean that both the music and the feeling. Grief manifests itself in such different ways in different people, you know. And for me, it was... I think everyone has probably worked out by now I don't mind a chat. So I just... talked about it. And we all did, actually, all of our family. We we talked about John and we talked about his illness and his suffering and how we were all feeling. And not because we were one of those, we were not like a modern family at all in that way where we all got around and hugged each other and did yoga together or anything. Like, you know, that's what we weren't. But we just talked about him naturally as if, you know, he was part of the family, which he was and he always will be. So that was kind of how we dealt with it, I guess.
Before he died, if I'm right, he told you that you needed to keep going with your music. Was there a point that you doubted whether you wanted to continue?
Yeah, and that's what I mean about grief, how it manifests itself. I mean, while he was sick, I was like, I think we were writing, Powderfinger, we were writing Vulture Street. And a few times I went to rehearsal, I guess, when we were working on stuff and he was sick. He was, you know, at home dying. And I was just like, what am I doing here? This is ridiculous. You know, being here writing songs, playing rock music. But that's also that thing. You have all these feelings of guilt and in the end it was actually the best thing for me, was having music to turn to. I mean, as well as having everybody around me. I mean, I got great support from my friends as well at the time, which is, you know, that's what they're for, aren't they? Mm. That's the whole idea of having friends is that you have all the good times together, but in times of difficulty, the people that you really rely on are the people that you're really close to.
It can be wonderful for that. And then again, during the devastating Brisbane floods in 2011, your dad, John, died.
Yeah. He'd been ill for a while. He had dementia. So he was suffering pretty badly from that for the last couple of years. He'd had it for a bit prior to that, and it wasn't as bad. You know, he was still at home and all that sort of stuff. But, yeah, he eventually died. I mean, he was 84. You never obviously want to lose one of your parents, but we all knew that he'd lived a really good life. So it was a different kind of sadness and grief around him.
You're going to sing a song for us that you wrote for both your brother and your dad, Blue Toowong Skies. Comes off your second solo album, Departures. Can you tell us about that song and what inspired it?
Having conversations with my sister Carmel and my brother Paul, I was turning 43 when I was writing that record, and Johnny was 42 when he died, so I was actually eclipsing him in age, which was really weird, being older than my oldest brother. So all of us had experienced that at the time when we turned 43. It was like, that's so weird. And so, yeah, I just started putting it into a song, that idea of the family tree and being once being the lowest branch and then being a middle branch now, especially, you know, because he had kids as well. So because both Dad and John are buried in the Toowong Cemetery, that's where they belonged. So all the lyrics are pretty literal.
Once I was the youngest, now the middle branch hung from the family tree. Older than my firstborn brother, never made it quite to 43. So let it ring, let the bell ring out for you. May it sing of your beautiful truth. Take your lead on the rising tide. Travel slow. Enjoy the ride.
So Powderfinger calls it unequivocal. Day gone, finished by in 2010.
Yep.
For 22 years, there was a commitment to this band that was enormous.
Mm-hmm.
Was it that responsibility that you had that by its nature demanded itself to be above everything else that became too much?
Yeah, that was definitely part of it. there was that idea that it's much easier when you're 23 to commit everything to an idea, like a band, than it is when you're 40. So, yeah, it was the responsibility of always being beholden to whatever was happening with Powderfinger. That was brought home most clearly to me by my wife, Andrea, had a heart operation when we were in Madrid, and I had to leave a week after that and go back to Australia and play a show. That was kind of one of the probably the turning point for me, where I just went, okay, that's not good. That was really difficult and sad situation to be in. And I guess I just wanted to be a bit more in control of my own individual destiny, you know, and hers as well. Not in control of her destiny, but I think you know what I mean. Yeah.
There was one last show. I mean, there was many last shows around the country, but the one, the very last one, happened in front of the Brisbane audience. And whilst they all would have been special, what was it like playing in front of that home crowd?
Oh, it was awesome, but it was really intense. It was pretty emotional. Like, it was a pretty charged atmosphere. There was a lot of build-up and hype around it. So it was a relief, actually, when it was over. I was super relieved that we'd made it through that whole tour, because I think it was a 9-week tour or something like that.
Yeah.
I can't remember how many shows we played, but
30-odd, wasn't it?
Something like that. I suppose, yeah. I think we played to 300,000 people or something around Australia. So, yeah, it was huge.
And then there's one, little Bernard Fanning by himself in the studio, which must be liberating for you, being able to make all those creative decisions for yourself. It's not this democracy, you know, across the line. But do you miss that?
It's a benevolent dictatorship.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Do you miss that collision of ideas that happens in a band, or is there something else that emerges here?
Of course. Absolutely, I miss that. It's much easier and harder to finish a song with five guys working on it than with one guy with five separate personalities working on it.
Do you know when to stop?
No. So now Nick Didier, who produced a whole lot of Powderfinger records and has just made my last two records, and he and I have a studio together, he kind of fulfills that role of saying that's not good enough, or that line could be a lot better, or those kinds of things that, yeah.
You've been a songwriter now for 30 years. You've written songs that songwriters would kill to have written. For you, though, have you written songs that have completely scratched that songwriter itch?
Oh, no, I don't think you can... It's an unscratchable itch, really. It's like golf or something. You're not ever going to win.
I didn't know you were going to say that.
You're never going to beat it, right? It's just something that you will always be able to improve at, being an artist that's creating something. That feeling of, I can do that better. Even the best songs that you've written, you can always find holes in them and go, that word is not good enough, or that harmony is crap, or whatever it is, you know. But, you know, taking pride in what you do is a really important part of actually whether you enjoy your job or not. I mean, I'm lucky that that's what my job is, to write songs. So.
You've got one song.
Yep, and it's a love song. It's about my wife. And and just having to suffer through being with a songwriter. Like, what a nightmare that is. Because, well, it is a really obsessive kind of pursuit. And so a lot of the time we'll be talking. If I'm in the process of writing a song, which might take a couple of days, I'll be looking at her and she'll be talking to me, and I'll be responding in all the right places, but I actually have no idea what she was talking about, because I'm singing the song inside my head.
I feel like that sounds like my marriage as well.
Yeah, well, maybe that's everyone's marriage, actually. Is that just husbands?
Yes.
but it's more, you know, that idea of saying to her, thank you for being so patient and understanding.
The song Emerald Flame, it comes off Civil Dusk, Bernard Fanning.
Thank you.
who could face this ruthless beauty? Masterpiece of fate and glory. Through simple silhouette and shadow, the bells of pardon ring in hollow. You have shattered my defenses. Now nothing will divide us. Through sacred fields, fallen fallow, we build the tenements of sorrow and step into this vacant future. Hopeful hallelujah. All to light the emerald flame beneath your brow. All to light the emerald flame. One of these days you'll see the best. Most nights now you wrestle with the rest of me. Let me steal you for the weekend. You can scatter my defenses. I guess if you still love me, then nothing will divide us.